Jeffrey Manuel is an associate professor of history at Southern Illinois University. He is a native Minnesotan and author of the new book, Taconite Dreams. Jeff, welcome to the Roadhouse and WTIP. So you're a native Minnesotan. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in the Twin Cities, specifically in Anoka. I went to high school at Anoka High School.
Well, before we get into the background on, you know, why you decided to write this book, I want to note that the subtitle of the book is Taconite Dreams, The Struggle to Sustain Mining on Minnesota's Iron Range from 1915 to 2000. You know, this is such an interesting book. It's very well written, but it also seems relevant given the news that next week on December 22nd, President Obama's chief of staff, Dennis McDonough, is coming to the Iron Range to talk about a global slump in the steel industry and its impact on workers. And, I mean, Jeff, this is such a recurring theme in your book, you know, I mean, from decade to decade of this involvement of sort of the boom and bust cycle, government involvement, and here we are. It's you know, we're having this discussion in the very next week. The chief of staff is coming to talk about this exact issue. I mean, what's your take on that news?
Yeah, it's a great question. I've obviously been following the news really closely, both this most recent announcement that Obama's chief of staff will be on the Iron Range and the broader news about the overall downturn that's just been, you know, rocking the Iron Range this fall and into the winter. So my heart really goes out to those folks who are directly affected. I mean, so many people are really directly affected with layoffs and stuff like that. And as you mentioned, you know, it's not the first time this has happened on the Iron Range. There have been a lot of these downturns, which I document, going the big one in the 1980s, the one in the 1950s. So, you know, the Iron Range has been here before, of course. Regarding the specific announcement about the Obama administration's chief of staff showing up on the Iron Range, you know, this is another recurring pattern where when the downturns hit, they get pulled into or the iron mining industry gets pulled into politics, both state politics and national politics. And that's obviously what's happening now. Big debate about this iron dumping issue. Are they going to raise tariffs, things like that? And that's obviously very important. And there's been a lot of coverage of that. I think the one thing I would add is just having looked at the Iron Range's mining economy over the long period of time, over about a century or so, I just always also go back to some of the fundamentals. And, you know, the fundamentals, unfortunately, are being driven right now by dropping demand from China, the low price of oil. So a lot of this steel was being made into pipes and tubes for the offshore oil and gas industry or the fracking industry, and that investment there has dried up as well. So I don't want to be cynical about sort of the possibilities for some political relief for the Iron Range right now. But of course, you know, there's only so much that public policy can do right now to change those fundamentals as well.
Mm-hmm. You know, you'd mentioned this boom and bust rhetoric, you know, and that's actually one of the aspects I found particularly interesting in the book, where miners believe the region is just one boom away from the good old days. But that mentality can actually be kind of a dangerous mindset. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah, that's one of the things I really wrestled with as I did the research that went into this book. You know, the most common way we talk about the economy on the Iron Range, and frankly in a lot of other mining and resource extraction regions, is this talk about a boom and bust, or some people call it a roller coaster, ups and downs, or turbulence. There's all kinds of metaphors people use. But, you know, as I started looking again at the longer history of the Iron Range and really putting it into perspective, it really struck me that what's happening here, what happened in the 20th century, was a long, much longer term decline in the iron ore mining industry. And by decline, I mean decline in terms of the numbers of jobs, number of people who are employed in those mines, decline in heavy industries and specifically mining's sort of cultural importance, both in Minnesota and the nation. And so looking at that whole picture, I really argue in the book that we should think of what happened in the 20th century not as sort of booms and busts, but as deindustrialization. And that's a big word, of course, but it's a term that historians and a lot of other scholars use to kind of describe this interrelated process where heavy industry like mining and steel and auto manufacturing and things like that has closed up shop in the United States and in Western Europe, been relocated to other parts of the globe where labor is cheaper, and sort of the cultural importance of it has shifted a lot. We don't think of these places as really at the heart of the American economy anymore in the way we used to, say, 50 years ago or so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very interesting. And, you know, before we get too far along, too, I want to get a little more into you and why you wanted to write this book. I mean, you mentioned you're a native Minnesotan, but why the Iron Range? Why the interest there, and specifically taconite mining and its history and impact on that region?
Yeah, sort of a circuitous route that led me to studying the Iron Range. But like you said, I'm from the Twin Cities region originally. And but my interest in the overall topic really started when I was an undergraduate history student. And I had a professor when I was getting my history degree. I went to Northwestern University. And a professor by the name of Joe Barton suggested that I take a look at the process of deindustrialization in Youngstown, Ohio. And if anybody's familiar with Youngstown, Ohio, it's in northeastern Ohio, kind of up along the Pennsylvania border. And it's just a really classic Rust Belt steel town. It's a town that the economy was almost totally centered on big steel mills. And in the period of about 3 years at the end of the 70s and early 80s, Youngstown steel industry gets really wiped out. And the town is just incredibly hard hit by these shutdowns. And so today it's still really struggling with a lot of population loss, deep poverty, things like that. And so I went to Youngstown kind of trying to understand what happened there and how this process changed the town. And then I came back to the University of Minnesota to get my PhD. I knew I wanted to study deindustrialization, and I was looking around for a more local or regional example in the upper Midwest. And that's what led me to the Iron Range. No one had really looked at this process in the Iron Range, and it's a Minnesota example. And it's also deeply connected to the steel industry. It's, you know, taconite's a raw material that's used to in the iron and steel industry. So that's what eventually brought me to start taking a look at what had happened on the Iron Range, and then that led me into taconite.
Mm-hmm. And how did you start your research? I mean, were you just going through archives? I know you referenced the New York Times and various publications throughout the book, but how did you begin your research? How did you go about collecting all this information?
Well, I wish I could tell you there was sort of a master plan behind it all, but the truth of the matter is that, like a lot of academic historians, I just started trying to get my hands on everything I could. I tried to read everything I could about the history of the Iron Range, and there are some good books out there. So I took a look at those first, and then I started diving into the archives. One of the great things about working in Minnesota history is that we just have a great archival community and local history community with the Minnesota Historical Society in St. Paul. I did a lot of research at the Iron Range Research Center at Iron World in Chisholm, and a lot of the local newspapers and national newspapers as well. So I did try and balance out, you know, the local sources that really give you the firsthand on the ground perspective on the Iron Range, but then also a lot of the industry and national and even international sources that kind of put the Iron Range in that national or international context. So that was one of the things I really tried to do during the, what frankly were years that went into doing the research for this book.
As you did this research, anything surprise you as you came across about the history of the range?
Yeah, a lot of things surprised me. I think the biggest surprise overall was just how much the entire taconite industry, which, you know, when we think of iron ore mining on the Iron Range today, it really is taconite. But really the whole taconite industry was an economic development plan meant to save the range during a previous downturn. That really surprised me, that how much rhetoric and worry there was in the first half of the 20th century, and then really at the middle of the 20th century, that the original form of iron ore mining, so-called natural or direct shipping ore, the hematite mines, were going to shut down, be depleted, run out, the mining was going to move on, and that the Iron Range was going to sort of turn into a string of ghost towns. And, you know, a lot of people familiar with mining 100 years ago looked at the history of mines out west. If you think of the examples out in the Rocky Mountains and places like that, where there were big mining booms, but then everybody left when the ore, when it was tapped out or no longer valuable, and they become ghost towns. And a lot of people thought that was going to happen to the Iron Range 100 years ago. But there was this really intense commitment, both by civic leaders in the region and by a lot of people in the industry, specifically people like the engineer Edward W. Davis, who I talk about a lot in the book, to develop this new kind of mining taconite, which is a low-grade ore, and really essentially save the range. So I think in many ways that story has been somewhat forgotten, that the entire basis for the industry today, the taconite, was a previous effort to save the range earlier in the 20th century.
Mm-hmm. You know, you talk about this term deindustrialization. To me, I mean, that term is simply the decline in industrial activity in a given region, if that is credible enough as a definition for that term. And, you know, your book argues that the Iron Range's modern history should be understood through this lens of deindustrialization. Why did you take that stand?
Well, like we talked about earlier, I think deindustrialization is a useful way of thinking about what's happened on the Iron Range in the 20th century. Well, for a number of reasons. I think one, it is a different way of looking at what happened versus, like we said, this boom and bust rhetoric. And the boom and bust rhetoric makes a lot of sense. But as I talk about, I think it has sort of short-circuited some more even-handed debate or analysis about the region and its past and its future. Like I said, you know, it's the boom and bust rhetoric has allowed a lot of folks in the allowed a lot of folks in the 20th century to sort of convince themselves that the region was always just one boom away from the good old days being back, and that has never proved true. It didn't prove true with the taconite boom in the 60s and 70s. It didn't really prove true with the more recent boom that had happened here in the 2000s with the run up of commodity prices, and it almost certainly won't prove true in the future. So I think looking at the entire thing as sort of this ongoing process of deindustrialization is more helpful. And I think it also allows us to think a little bit more, not just about the economy in terms of, you know, the numbers of jobs lost or, you know, millions of tons of iron ore production or things like that. I mean, those are obviously very important. But I think there is an important cultural aspect to all this. It's both political and cultural. I talk a lot about how the Iron Range and iron ore mining has been really a central part of the state's politics and national politics at times in the 20th century. But also there's this really important cultural part of it that, you know, people on the Iron Range in the 20th century, earlier in the 20th century, really knew that, you know, the iron ore they were producing, which was turned into steel in these massive integrated steel mills as part of the Great Lakes Industrial Complex, they really knew that that was central to an industrializing United States, that that was sort of modernizing, moving the nation forward, you know, central to steel-clad armed forces and things like that. And I think that sensibility of industrial production and specifically heavy industry being so central to sort of the region, the nation's identity and what the United States is and things like that has really been lost somewhat. So I think that process of feeling marginalized is part of the deindustrialization experience as well.
Mm-hmm. You know, but you also kind of expand on, too, how deindustrialization, particularly as it pertains to the Iron Range, that it doesn't have to be this all or nothing outcome. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah. You mean in terms of just not a total shutdown?
Yeah, well,
not,
I mean, yeah. You know, it's relevant even today where there's thousands of jobs have been lost this year alone. And, you know, grocery stores closing down in some of these mining towns, businesses closing down. So can you just explain to us about this concept of how it doesn't really have to be all or nothing?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. But I think that it's not a matter of sort of there's going to be the entire region's industry will be focused entirely on mining jobs, and that will lead to good times versus, you know, all the mines are going to close, everybody will be out at work, everyone will have to leave. Certainly, yeah, that's not going to be the case. That neither the most sort of optimistic predictions of the boosters have ever been proven true on the Iron Range, nor have the sort of most pessimistic concerns of the critics been proven true either. So I tried really hard in the book, you know, to be as objective and factual as possible to sort of carve out and describe that middle ground gray area, which again is neither, you know, the sort of utopian dreams of the taconite's boosters in the 20th century. You know, there were people predicting in the 1920s and 1930s saying, hey, if we switch over to taconite, this low-grade ore, there's so much of it, we'll be able to keep a vibrant mining economy here going for centuries, maybe half a millennia. And, you know, already by the 1980s, the industry's in real trouble and things like that. So those really optimistic dreams never proved true. But the flip side, is that some of the most pessimistic concerns have never proven true either. You know, there was just deep concern in the 1980s that the entire region was headed again back to ghost town status or something like that. And that obviously hasn't proven true either. You know, there's still a lot of folks living in the Iron Range who've made career, who've made a life there. The region's economy has really diversified since the beginning of the time period I talk about in the book. There's just a lot of stuff there that's very different than it was 100 and even 50 years ago. You know, the rise of a much much broader and more vibrant tourism industry, the healthcare industry, things like that. So yeah, that it's not sort of an all or nothing. It's going to be, I try in the book to point out that it's more complicated than an all or nothing, whatever happens to the mine story on the Iron Range.
Mm-hmm. But still, the future of the taconite industry in Minnesota, you know, remains unclear at best. And, you know, blast furnace technology giving way to electric arc furnaces, supply from around the world eclipsing the range in both quantity and cost. Which brings us to the Bob Dylan song you quote and reference in the book, North Country Blues. I mean, Dylan talks about South American towns where it's cheaper to get the ore. You know, it's still, and that's from the 60s, and it's still relevant today. I mean, did you find that link interesting?
Yeah, I certainly did. You know, I've been thinking about this issue a lot recently with, as you mentioned, you know, sort of all the really bad news coming out about the iron ore industry in Minnesota and the shutdowns and, you know, these new mines coming online. Yeah, like in South America, Australia, places like that, that, you know, by all appearances have a lot lower cost of production than the Iron Range mines at this point and are much closer to the big centers of demand in China and East Asia. But like you said, I mean, there's just a lot of echoes of what had happened in the 1950s and 1960s. And that's one of the things I've really been thinking a lot about is, you know, the sort of historical parallels there. And let me say this, you know, standard historians caveat that, you know, there's the historical analogies are never perfect. And most importantly, I can't predict the future any more than anybody else, of course. I'm in the business of talking about the past. But there are some important historical parallels between the situation the Iron Range faced in the 1950s and 1960s and the situation it faces today. I think a lot of people have gone back to the big downturns and layoffs of the 1980s when they're thinking about today, and that's certainly relevant as well. But I've been thinking about a lot of ways in which that downturn of the 50s and 60s might be a more relevant parallel for the situation that the Iron Range is facing today. Because that's really the situation that Bob Dylan was talking about in North Country Blues, if people know that song. And it's the situation that, you know, compelled Bob Dylan and many thousands of other young people to leave the Iron Range in the 1950s and early 1960s. But the deep downturn and really sort of regional depression that hit the Iron Range in the 1950s, right through the very beginning of the 1960s, has been sort of forgotten today, both in the state of Minnesota and even on the Iron Range. In part, it's just, you know, sort of moving out of living memory for a lot of people in a way that the 1980s are still, you know, there's a lot of folks around who still really remember that very well. But also that the 1950s downturn got overturned really quickly and pretty dramatically with the construction of the big taconite mines and mills, starting with the very first ones in the mid-1950s on sort of an experimental basis. And then, as I talk about in the book, in 1964, the state passed the taconite amendment to the Minnesota state constitution that guaranteed sort of equitable tax treatment to taconite producers. And that led to a real boom in taconite plant construction in the 1960s. So a lot of folks, you know, with this, when there was a big upturn in the jobs in taconite in the middle of the 1960s and then all through the 1970s, they really sort of forgot about what had happened in the 1950s. But to my mind, that situation in the 50s of sort of the sense that the Iron Range is really struggling, even though other parts of the state and the nation are doing really well, which seems to be the case again today, and the sense that other parts of the globe, they're discovering these rich new sources of ore, they're cheaper, they're going to be available here, they're going to undercut the Iron Range ore. I mean, all that stuff was what they were talking about in the 50s and 60s as well. And of course, we're talking about it again today.
You know, one aspect I wanted to talk about was the pollution that you discuss in the book, where, you know, down here, down the road from us in Grand Marais, down at Silver Bay, when the taconite mine, when the processing plant was built, you know, they were dumping an average of 67,000 tons of tailings, mine waste, into Lake Superior each day. And that went on from 1955 to roughly 1980. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just unbelievable to think about, really. And not only that, but that, you know, when they kind of came to light on that, hey, something's wrong with this process, in the 70s, it still took about 10 years of, you know, litigation and court activity to resolve that. I mean, that's just such an unbelievable number, 67,000 tons a day. into the big lake.
Yeah, the scale of the tailings waste getting dumped into Lake Superior is just sort of mind-boggling, I think. And you can go back and look at the photos of it where they just have these enormous tubes just, you know, blowing the stuff out into Lake Superior. And to our modern eyes, it just looks, frankly, sort of horrifying. But I think what I tried to do in the book is really go back and place that in the context of the decisions being made when the E.W. Davis Works, which is the big was the original name of the big reserve mining company mill in Silver Bay, was being created and planned and all that kind of stuff. I talk a lot about the reserve mining company versus USA lawsuit as this real watershed change that's happened when suddenly the environmental consequences of mining have to be dealt with in a way that they just weren't really considered earlier in the 20th century. You know, the concern then was, hey, whatever was going to lead to economic development, go for it. But the reserve mining pollution trial, I think, really signaled a real watershed where suddenly there's this other question of saying, well, you know, jobs, yes, but at what cost to the environment, and how do we balance those two? And that also is, of course, right where we're at today. I mean, in some ways, that's the fundamental question being asked about somewhat about taconite mining, but really especially about these proposed new copper nickel mines in the region, mm-hmm. you know, where there's just been tremendous controversy in the state and nationwide about should they go forward with these and the jobs versus the environment debate.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And Jeff, is this your first book that you've published?
This is it. Yeah, this is my first book that I published. You know, I did a lot of the original research for this when I was doing my PhD, and I've continued to do research about it. So it's the first book, hopefully not the last, but I've really enjoyed all the research digging up all these this info for the book.
Yeah, that's great. Well, the book is Taconite Dreams. We've been talking with the author, Jeff Manuel. And thanks a lot for your time, Jeff. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Joe. It's great to talk to you.
They complain in the east they're paying too high. They say that your ore ain't worth digging, that it's much cheaper down in the South American towns, where the miners work almost for nothing.